If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Welcome to another exciting edition of The Thoughts Police. It is that time of the week once more where we roll around the idea that Boris Johnson is in fact still in charge of the country. Kevin O'Sullivan's here with me. Very good afternoon to you, Kev.
Hello, mate.
I put out a tweet yesterday in which I pondered the question, would we be better off with a cardboard cutout of Boris Johnson? Because I found one on the internet for about £12.50. And it'd be a lot cheaper, wouldn't he? Because since he can't seemingly operate...
The cardboard cutout would be better at Zoom.
Yeah, well, the cardboard cutout would be better at Zoom. Also, you wouldn't matter if you couldn't hear what he was saying because he hasn't got much to say anyway. He did an entire press conference stroke speech to Parliament without actually saying anything.
I know. Last night's great announcement to the nation was basically there will be an announcement on Thursday.
Yeah.
These are psychological tricks. There's no doubt about it now.
Also, I was told today by John Rentall that he didn't believe a word of the actual... Wi-Fi falling over, that he actually thought that Boris... And, I mean, this is quite a serious allegation for a proper political writer
to
make.
Scrutiny
that he actually deliberately went off air so he wouldn't have to face people like Graham Brady.
Yeah, Graham Brady was the next question. Mm. Funny it crashed then, wasn't it? I mean, it's either that, and that's disgraceful, or the other disgraceful possibility is that this befuddled old git can't use Zoom.
Well, how about Downing Street gets a slightly better... piece of machinery. I mean, Dan Wooden said this. He said, well, surely they could get him a sort of microphone which is broadcast ready. Surely they could put him into a studio in Downing Street. Surely they could produce some kind of green screen. I mean, these things are not that difficult to do.
Well, as John Rentall pointed out on your show this morning, in the past, they have actually run cables from Parliament to number 10 Downing Street. It's only 350 metres. Yeah. So why didn't they do that to make sure they had a connection? But that tends to make you suspect that he deliberately wanted his
Zoom to
crash.
You can't imagine if they were doing this from the Oval Office in the United States of America, that it would look like that. Or sound like that.
Yes, it's just, you can't...
It's Toy Town stuff.
You couldn't make it up. Press mute, mute's not work, mute. God's sake, you're the Prime Minister,
I know, it's really quite shocking.
But as you say, Mike, then he went on to address the nation later on in the evening and said nothing, precisely nothing, except this sophistry that I'm very happy to announce that after a month of lockdown, we will be coming out of lockdown on December the 3rd. Here's a new thing. It's a different kind of lockdown. It's called Tier 3.
Yes.
I mean, this is just a lockdown by any other name.
It's just like keep calling it. Next, they'll be doing one of those fire bricks.
Yeah, fire
they had in Wales. You know, I haven't used that one yet.
Yeah, and by the way, suddenly, so we've been talking about Christmas, suddenly, last night, Easter's in the frame.
Right.
This is endless.
Right.
Endless.
I know. It's basically bonkers, isn't it? But let's move away from Boris for a moment, because I've got to ask you about Fulham, because by bizarre coincidence, right, on Saturday night, we were watching something, and we stopped watching it anyway, so I found myself in front of the TV on my own watching Match of the Day, and I saw this remarkable penalty.
Yeah, there's the second...
Now, this is the second week in a row that somebody from Fulham has managed to completely fluff a penalty.
Well, when Edmola Lookman last week took the worst penalty ever taken by anyone ever in football.
Right.
Absolutely pathetic. Basically chipped it into the goalkeeper's arms.
Of the waiting arms of the goalkeeper.
This week, Ivan Caballero, who was brought in...
I thought this one was worse, actually.
Yeah, he tripped over before he hit the ball and it went, skied it over the bar.
Man.
You have to remember with Fulham, we have a long and noble... tradition of missing penalties. Four seasons ago, we made it to the playoffs, but lost in the playoffs. But we would have got automatically promoted had we not that season have missed 10 penalties.
Really?
Missing penalties is an absolute sickness at my fucking
club. Well, you're turning
club.
Into an art form at the moment, because this one was fantastic. I mean, everyone remembers the John Terry slip in that Champions League final, right? Which was unfortunate for him. But somehow it wasn't as bad as this one.
Yeah.
This one, because not only did he slip, and so he didn't just miss-kick it slightly, he kind of ballooned it over the bar didn't he?
He slipped and then sort of scooped his foot under the... But, I mean, to be fair to him, it wasn't really his fault. I suppose sometimes you do slip up, ask Stevie Gerrard.
Yeah.
But it was a disgusting and revolting result. But I was actually on air on Sunday when that game started, at midday.
Right.
So I said to the boys, right, get the match on in the studio. Right. So I was sitting there with an eye on it. I mean, the kickoff came.
It was a bad idea.
I'm in the middle of an interview and Everton scored after 30 seconds. I kind of lost my thread a bit.
I'm not surprised. Absolutely right. But, you know, the funny thing is that people talk about penalties all the time. And there used to be that school of thought where there was no point in practicing a penalty because you can't recreate the situation. Well, yes, you can't recreate the situation, although at the moment there is no situation because there's no crowd. There's no baying sort of supporters from behind the goal, you know, wishing you dead or anything like that. So actually, you can practice penalties and you can keep kicking the ball into the net so that when you actually do have to try and kick the ball into the net, you can do it.
Well, I gather that Ivan Caballero, who was brought in as our new penalty taker after the disaster of the last one, and by the way, that's after Mitrovic missed a penalty the week before against Sheffield United.
So it's just the third week in a row that Fulham have missed a penalty.
Yeah, yeah. So Mitro.
That's a pretty good statistic.
On the third match in a row because of the international break. But Mitro lost his confidence, so he didn't want to do it again because he missed one against Serbia.
Right.
While playing for Serbia as well. So they bring in Lookman. He fucks it up royally. Right. So apparently all last week, Ivan Caballero has been practicing penalties. A lot of fucking good that
did. There must be something to it, mustn't there? Because I think it's probably
psychological
true.
Now,
if you do think you're going to miss it, you're going to miss it. It's that simple.
I know. We've got a problem there. But we've got lots of problems.
But isn't that why it's really... I mean, I find this quite interesting when you look at individual sportsmen and people like Wayne Rooney, who's taken a lot of flack over the years for all sorts of things. But he's got a very kind of concentrated mind, so that no matter what's going on in his private life, no matter what's being said to him on the pitch... Yeah. He's always kind of at the races, isn't he?
Yeah. Some players can do that. Some players can rise above anything else that's going on. But there is definitely at Fulham now a kind of collective psychological problem when it comes to taking penalties.
Right.
And it dates back way before this season, as I just
explained.
Well, they're
going to have to do something about it, though, isn't he, the old manager? He's going to have to get them out there and just go, like, we're just going to kick penalties into the fucking goal for the rest of the week.
Well, I don't want to dwell too much on our penalty problems and Fulham and all that, but one last point. So we have a young manager who I think is pretty good, Scott Parker, former player. And
well,
all
he was
that.
A decent player, wasn't
he? Yeah, a decent player and a good little guy, a good manager, I think. Not, I would say, the most intellectual man on the place.
That's not what you need.
But he... after Lookman fucked that penalty up, he goes, because Lookman's like 21, 22 years old. So don't forget, that's right at the end of the game. Very crucial point. We could have equalised. And Parker goes, well, the boy's made a mistake. He knows that. He'll learn from it. The boy could have done better, but the boy will learn from that. He's very young. And I'm thinking, well, if he's a boy and he's very fucking young, why did you get him to take the fucking penalty, you fucking idiot?
Well, he wanted to teach him a lesson, obviously.
Fuck bloody people in football. They're so stupid.
Well, they can be, yeah. But anyway, that's enough of your personal grief.
That's another personal misery.
For the moment. Let's talk a little bit about America, because today... For the first time, we're seeing reports from the US of A that Trump has basically conceded, not quite in the way that maybe he was meant to, and not completely sort of, you know, full concession speech time. But he has now agreed that that Biden, for the moment, is the winner, and he will take part in this transition process, which releases money to Joe Biden, who I'm rather not surprised to say, seems to be rehiring all the bozos that were in the Barack Obama White House.
Of course he does. I think that Trump's tactic is this. I suspect he's got something out of Georgia. He's got something to show the American people. Look, here's an example of the voter fraud that was going on. I say it was going on in a lot of other states as well.
But we can't prove
it. But if he's got one bit of evidence, then he can bow out with some dignity saying, look, I wasn't lying.
Yeah.
So... And I think he's right now to finally kind of concede.
Yeah.
Because it
was going very dry, wasn't it?
Yeah, he needs to bow out of the White House with dignity. Mm. And then I am in no doubt he will launch his, or already has really, launch his campaign to be the next president of the United States.
Do you think? I mean, I'm not sure he'll want to do that. But yeah. I mean, I certainly think he'll want to be a thorn in the side of Biden, which won't be difficult to do, by the way.
Yeah, by the way, I've been thinking, how am I going to spend that 10 quid that Mike Graham owes me?
Well, as I said to you, until the actual fat lady sings, you will not be getting any of my money. So I reckon you'll be waiting until January.
By the way, just talking to people who Welsh on bets, I'm sure you wouldn't Welsh.
I certainly wouldn't. And
I don't care if you do, actually. But Boris Johnson once bet Max Hastings, when Max Hastings was his editor. Yeah. They had a 1,000 quid bet on something. And I can't remember what the topic was. It was something similar to us. Right. It was a political thing. Yeah. Bet you they don't do this. And they did do it.
Right.
And Max said, you owe me 1,000 quid. And Boris sent him an envelope saying, please find enclosed my cheque for £1,000, an empty envelope.
Really?
Nothing in there.
Really?
He's no tourist. Apparently, he's never been seen to buy a drink ever in the history of his
isn't
life.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. You know, as you learn more and more about some people, they surprise you less and less, don't they?
Yeah.
Because that's the kind of thing you would expect. Because whenever you meet, it's like people that I meet, and you've played a bit of golf in your time, people who cheat at golf.
Yes.
You kind of go, you're not really cheating me, you're now cheating yourself.
What is the point?
You know, if you're going to finish, I mean, when I used to play, I've told this story before, I used to play in this European Press Golf Association with my dad when I was a bit younger. And there was this old German guy whose name was something like Ralph, somebody or other. And you'd literally not see him from the tee to the green.
And
he'd go, fumph. Everything was fumph. He became known as Ralph Fumph because everything was five. Whenever he putted in, and you'd be seeing him hacking away in the woods, you know, he's taken at least 10 shots to get out of the fucking woods, and he's got five.
Yeah, the golfers are more footballers than golfers. They kick the ball
around. And to be
fair,
that's what they say about Trump, isn't it?
Trump's the kicker of the ball,
kicks the ball over. And, you know, so we should talk actually about Ivor Key, who you may or may not remember.
Our old friend, yeah, from New York. Yeah,
from New York.
Is,
and
yeah.
Paul Callan, two of our old colleagues that passed away this week.
Both legends.
Ivor Key was my best man, funnily enough, when I got married back in 1987 in New York.
Yeah.
And he was one of the great kind of miserable old gits, I think, that I've ever met. And he took great delight in it. I was talking to George Gordon over in the States about him, and he said that they'd basically taken his driver's license off him, which was much to the delight of all Connecticut residents because of the danger he was causing on the roads. But also, he didn't get on with most members of his family. But one of his daughters didn't speak to him. And I think the other one...
Melissa,
she's out in... She's working for Dr. Phil now, apparently.
Is she?
Over in LA. His other daughter, he did speak to, but he didn't visit. You know, and he was just this very kind of crotchety, curmudgeonly Yorkshireman. But a very funny guy.
Yeah.
He once said to me as we were driving, because we used to go, and I introduced them all to playing golf when I was living there.
Yeah.
And we used to drive up to this place called the Delaware Water Gap. And on a Saturday morning, he was sitting in the car with me once. And you know how in Manhattan, if you drive at the right pace, all the lights just turn green at the same time.
You're trying to get
and
that
we started
magic
to get a little bit too quick, and we ended up stopping at one light. And this old guy was walking across the road very slowly. And Ivor just said to me, you know, the thing is, he said, I don't think I want to be living in Manhattan, you know, when I get older and I get retired. There's no place for old people. And just as he said that, this guy sort of appears in front of the car and he winds the window down and goes, get out of the way, you old prick! You know, and that sort of summed him up, really. That he didn't care very much about anybody else at all, but he was a great guy. So we mourn his passing. And Paul Callan, the father of Jessica Callan, who used to work for you as one of the three AM girls. I mean, he was an incredible character. This was a guy who wrote colour pieces before anything had ever happened. I mean, he was famous for getting on a plane and sort of creating and crafting this beautiful piece of colourful writing and then working out whether or not that would actually tally with what had happened.
Yeah, he was an excellent writer. Funny enough, I mean, Paul, great guy. Every time, funny guy.
If you ever
walked into a pub and Paul was sitting at the bar, you knew you were going to have some fun.
Yeah.
He was a guy of the old Fleet Street tradition where he didn't let work get too much in the way of his drinking and his socialising, but did crop up now and again to write great big spreads in the paper. But the funny thing about what Paul specialised in brilliantly, which was colour writing, is it doesn't really exist anymore.
No.
Every paper had their star colour writer. So if there was a big news story, even a court case, they'd send down the colour writer to depict it.
To sort of craft
with great writing. Right. And I lament the passing of that, because you don't get that anymore. And by the way, while we're talking about newspapers, what a disgrace these papers are being throughout this COVID crisis. The other day, was it 2 days ago? Christmas is on.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. What about the other 4 months that isn't on?
Right.
You know, this is they're just lapping up this government propaganda bullshit, swallowing it whole and regurgitating it.
Well, thank God for the Daily Mail, to be honest, because it was down to them that the Secretary of State for Health and indeed the whole Department of Health were held up to ridicule with that ridiculous tweeting business at the weekend, where they tweeted that this is a very misleading article.
Yeah.
And what's even worse since then is the bozos who've kind of jumped on the bandwagon have started attacking the Mail for using statistical information which wasn't accurate. One of them was an MP called O'Brien, I think his name was, and I was thinking to myself, well, I wish you were scrutinising government figures as much as you're scrutinising the Daily Mail figures, because you'd find an awful lot of misleading data there as well.
And the most damning thing you need to know about that little saga was, of course, when the Daily Mail complained to the Department of Health, you prove that this article is misleading before you start posting that on Twitter. Mm. Guess what? The Department of Health deleted their tweet because they can't prove it.
Can't
in other
prove
words,
it.
Ross Clark, who wrote the show, who wrote the I said show, I'm hoping to get him on my show tonight, who wrote the article, his article was absolutely true.
Yeah, it was.
It was absolutely
and
true.
And also, those who are picking holes in it are picking holes in one graph.
Yeah.
Which they say was based on incorrect information because it came from somebody called
some of the
statistics guy.
Let's go through some of the things that Ross wrote. Ross is a very respected journalist, writes for The Spectator. He's not a red-top kind of fly merchant.
Right.
He writes proper stories and great articles. He's an intelligent man.
Mm.
What did he say? 53% of the people who die from COVID are over 80.
Mm-hmm.
95% of them who die from COVID have other conditions.
Yeah, right.
In other words, the government and the Department of Health are grossly overstating the seriousness of the threat from COVID.
And also the argument about the beds, right, which is what some of them have picked holes in as well. Because you see these people and it's like, well, what exactly are you doing here? Why are you attacking the Daily Mail, which is, to all intents and purposes, one of the few newspapers which is actually looking into these figures and examining them and asking questions about them? Why are you suddenly attacking them rather than the government, which has led us down this merry path for the best part of the last 8 months with hardly any scrutiny whatsoever from anybody in what you would call the mainstream media?
Yeah.
But these people are so intent on disproving the Daily Mail because they think it's a fascist hate rag, that they will go to any lengths to make out that they've got it wrong. And in fact, they haven't got it wrong. Most of these explanations that I've seen have said things like, well, the reason, of course, that the beds numbers are different is because they've included places like Moorfields Eye Hospital and they've included places like mental health units, which wouldn't have COVID patients in them anyway. But also, what they don't say is that, but the government's official figures on how COVID beds are filling up are also bollocks because what they're not telling you is that if there's only 10 COVID beds and you fill those up, you're at a crisis point, but you've got another 90 beds somewhere else, which are not COVID beds. And that's where all this kind of delusional stuff goes on.
And the Nightingale hospitals have never been more than 1.5% full.
Well, most of them were never used at all.
Hospital occupation is below average for this time of year.
Yeah.
All of these statistics are shocking, given that the government is telling us we're in the middle of a dreadful pandemic akin to the bubonic plague. We so fucking aren't.
Well, I think they should be told that during the time of the bubonic plague, people were dropping dead in the street.
Yes.
Right, they were dying before
your
very eyes.
Well, that's what they want us to think.
Yeah, but nobody's dropping dead in the street. Nobody's dying before our very eyes. And quite frankly, what I would like to see more of is the figures of people who go into hospital but then come out again.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I had a guy on today whose elderly mother was taken into hospital with COVID earlier in the year. She, despite the fact that she was in her mid-80s, despite the fact that she was quite ill and she was in hospital for 3 to 4 weeks, she recovered.
Yeah.
And she came out. And that's what happens to 99% of people.
Yeah, it's the central narrative that this government obsessively promotes, which is this is a dreadful health pandemic. Millions of us will die. Bubonic plague.
Yeah, but have a test, even if you haven't got any symptoms, if you don't know who's got it.
Yeah, it's
wrong.
That's
how deadly it is.
Their central narrative is wrong. It's a lie, and it's quite clearly being propagated by them to back up their drastic approach to it at the start. Mm. They're trying to justify what they did at the beginning by carrying on being drastic. And
I think it's because they've still basically been bewitched by the likes of Chris Whitty, who made his first appearance for a long time, by the way, last night, because he hadn't been seen for a while.
Yeah.
But they've now fallen into this other argument, which is, oh, we're all going to be saved by the vaccine. Isn't it going to be great? You see, the Russians came out with a vaccine today, and they're saying that they're going to flog it for $10 per hit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you want to get yourself a Russian vaccine, be my guest. I'm not sure I would recommend it, but they are going to be selling it in different parts of the world. Yeah. They'll sell it in the Middle East. They'll probably sell it in China. They may well sell it in parts of the Far East as well, because it's a lot cheaper, frankly.
Well, the thing about the vaccines, the government is like, well, Boris is sort of gathering around this good vaccine news, massively. And, you know, I don't want to be pessimistic about this. I'm sure it's all going to be great and all that. Well, I'm not sure. But let's just remember.
I'm sure it's going to be great. Actually, I'm not sure.
Well, I'm not sure because there are three vaccines, the wonder vaccines. They're going to save the world. Can I just point out none of them have been approved?
Yeah.
None of them.
Mm.
AstraZeneca.
I'm sure they will be.
AstraZeneca, it's just to prove the kind of world we're in here. These big pharma companies, what they're really about is making tons and tons of money. And there's a lot of money in the coronavirus vaccine. So AstraZeneca announced 2 days ago, we've done it. We found the vaccine. It's 70% successful. It's got a 70% success rate.
Mm.
AstraZeneca's share price promptly plummeted
because
Pfizer's and Moderna's have got a 90% success
but
rate.
But nobody actually knows what
that means. So guess what AstraZeneca did today? They announced, oh, no, we got it wrong. It's 90%. My ass.
Yeah, but that's like some of these statements that they put out from all sorts of government agencies and government organisations. Oh, I got that wrong. Do you remember the woman who came out and said, Susan Hopkins, I think it was, who came out and said, oh, it'll be 2 days for every 1 day that you have for Christmas that will have to punish you. And then they went,
she got that
wrong. It's five.
Yeah.
Yeah, she meant to say five. She didn't mean to say two. Really? Are you sure about
this? Well, this whole thing about Christmas, it's central to the equation. You know, it's not just about this alleged disease and the threat of it. This is about the philosophy of the way a free Western country should be governed. They cannot and must not interfere in how we spend Christmas and with whom we choose to spend Christmas. It has got fuck all to do with the government.
Except that, Kevin, if they do not interfere with what we do, then how is that in any way defensible by the use of the science? Because if the science tells them that for the rest of the year, apart from 5 days around Christmas, they have to tell us how to behave, then clearly it means that actually they don't have to tell us how to behave because they're not doing it for Christmas.
Yeah.
Why would they do it for the rest of the time?
Yeah, I mean, they are, don't get me wrong, they are going to interfere in our Christmas. They keep saying,
well, they're going to try.
Christmas won't be normal this year. I'll tell you what, Boris, it fucking well will for loads and loads of people.
Well, it will be.
Who are going to ignore everything you say.
I haven't met anyone yet who says that they're not going to have a normal Christmas. Everyone I know is having a normal Christmas, whatever that is.
I was listening to your show this morning, again, John Rentoul, excellent guy, always a good listen. But he's sort of putting forward, he listens to the polls a lot. He keeps putting forward, lots and lots of people want stricter restrictions. They want stricter measures.
Yeah.
I don't believe that.
No.
And I do not believe people support any more lockdowns.
I mean, I do see occasional kind of, you know, musings on social media by people who have those views. And there are people who are genuinely worried about their elderly relatives and all of that. But that's fine. They don't have to do anything.
It's their choice,
not like we're saying to them, right, well, now you have to invite me and Kevin O'Sullivan into your house so we can drink the place dry, cough all over you, and then leave. That's not what's happening.
Sir Desmond Swain, that redoubtable backbench Tory, good guy, was on my show.
I heard him last night. Yeah.
On my show. Well, did you hear what he said? He said, look, I've got a very elderly mother.
Mm.
I want her to come. I'm going to invite her to my house for Christmas. But she's obviously very vulnerable. It is her decision whether or not she wants to come to my house. Mm. It's not mine. It's not the government.
No.
You know, this is a Western democracy.
Exactly right.
You cannot
interfere
in our lives.
Over in America,
like
I mean,
this.
You'll remember, this is Thanksgiving week, right? So normally speaking, the whole of America basically grinds to an entire halt. I used to have a nightmare at Thanksgiving because I would always go and see my kids when they were living there. And unfortunately, their mother was never very much help at sort of getting them anywhere close to where I was going to be. So I'd have to usually fly to somewhere like, you know, Philadelphia, hire a car, drive to Washington, D.C., go through acres and acres of traffic out towards Reston, Virginia, where they lived, and then try and get them back to a train that I could get on. And I nearly missed the final last train out of there to Connecticut. And I would only ever go for like 3 or 4 days. It was absolutely fucking nightmare, right? But, you know, it's a proper holiday.
Not giving Thanksgiving
for
that.
It's a proper holiday, right? And My sister, Mari, who you know well, is having a little Thanksgiving thing. But my mother, who's now 96, right, and is certainly frail. I mean, she's as strong as an ox in a way because she's now fallen twice and the doctors are like, you should be dead. But she's okay. She's got two friends.
I don't think your mum's ever going to die.
No, I know. Well, people say
she's indestructible.
It's going to be her and Keith Richard at the end of the world.
By the way, Keith Richard has given up smoking.
Has he?
Why?
What for?
Yeah, he's about 90.
Oh, yeah, I was thinking I might have done myself a bit of damage. Do you reckon?
I just found out they're bad for you.
Yeah, do you reckon, Keith? You know, I think he's given up all drink apart from beer as well.
That's so depressing.
I know, it really is. But, you know, she's got two friends coming in from the city, from New York. Both of whom she said, look, if you don't want to come, because I think there's a similar kind of thing in place where you're not really supposed to travel. But she said, look, if you're happy to come, we're happy to have you. And my mother said to my sister, of course I'd want them to come because I want to have some company. You know, can you imagine if she was on her own? Never mind just with my sister, you know, with nobody to see, nobody to talk to. That's not what most people want if they're old. And it's not what most people want, even with the risk that they're going to run. They'll go there. She said they won't have any contact with her. They'll sit around the dining table, reasonably well spaced out, and it'll be fine.
But it's their decision.
And it's their, but they're taking that decision. Mm-hmm. And my mother in particular is making the decision for herself because she wants some company.
We've got a big mission creep going on this side of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And that is a government and a prime minister who have forgotten that it isn't their business to interfere in our personal
lives.
They've
definitely got the taste for it,
haven't they? As you said this morning, Mike, apparently couples can have sex together, but they can't play tennis.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, this is what
I wouldn't be against that, to be honest, because I'm not a big fan of tennis.
Game, set and match, that's fucked you.
But somebody did put a question mark over the on Twitter saying, can you fuck your wife on a tennis court? I'm not quite sure what the answer is to that. There'll be some regulation against it, no doubt. Maybe it'll have to be your own tennis court.
Yeah, that's 40, love.
Juice. But, you know, the thing is, it's reached ridiculous proportions now. Where you just, there are reasons, like that poor woman up in Worcestershire, who we've been getting on the show.
The shop lady,
The shop lady, who's basically just the salt of the earth kind of person that you want on your side in any situation in this country. And what this country used to be made up of. You know, not the dozy police officers who came in and said, well, I've got this bit of paper here, says that you've got to shut the shop. You know, she's going, no, bollocks, I'm not doing it. Lost. Find me then and watch me not pay.
And let's just quickly talk about some, you know, I mean, it seems to me now, I can't think of any other explanation except the government's got it in for pubs and restaurants.
Yeah.
They don't want us to enjoy ourselves anymore.
Yeah. What's that all about?
They think 75% of our pubs, 75% of all pubs and restaurants are going to close down because of what's happening to them. And the theatres, by the way, theatres in the West End, you know, this is the jewel of one of
these
the jewels.
These are massive businesses.
This is one of the jewels of our country. This is the West End is the finest theatre land in the entire world. Right. Everyone knows that. And last week, I picked up the Evening Standard, the local London paper, and I was confused because there are all these adverts for pantos and Christmas specials at all the theatres, how to get tickets. So I got Matt Hemley onto my show on Sunday, and he's the news editor of The Stage, the theatrical Bible newspaper. And I said, what's going on? I didn't realise the theatres were open. And he said, well, at this stage, they're not. This is just a hope. Anyway.
So what, they're selling tickets for something that might not happen?
Well, I think if you try to get them, they'll say, well, they're not quite available now.
Right.
They're placing adverts for productions that may well not go on. And now they're once again feel that they won't be able to open.
Yeah.
So they're hoping against hope there'll be light at the end of the tunnel on Thursday. But I don't think there will. And that's then, another industry that's going to die.
But then, do you remember that big row about Arsene Wenger because he appeared at London Palladium? In an interview for his book.
Yeah.
And there were loads of people in the audience, all of which we were told later by the organisers were properly socially distanced. How can something like that go ahead if nothing else can open? I don't understand how people can always make these little exceptions.
Well, you know, remember Arsene Wenger, every time that an Arsenal player fouled someone terribly, he didn't see
it. He never saw it.
Well, he probably didn't see the audience.
No,
there was a big audience there, Arsene.
No, I mean, it's very strange. And, you know, if this lockdown goes to the end of its sort of time on December the 2nd, but then becomes a worse lockdown, because technically
it's
could.
Worse.
Because actually a tier three is worse than what we have now.
Yeah, yeah.
Because nobody would be going anywhere.
For lots of people, this is going to be a worse lockdown. We said earlier, he didn't really announce anything. He didn't announce anything concrete, but what he sort of announced in principle was we're going to be locked down until Easter, and he can fuck off.
Right. He also, I think, said that lots of local authorities, all of these little Hitlers, are going to have even more strength
and ability, which is
very, very worrying.
You know what
they're
like with their high-vis jackets?
Oh, I know.
Get back into your house!
Yeah, what are you doing out?
Put those lights out!
Well, what about this other ludicrous thing where the people who are going to football matches now will be told that they can't basically speak or sing? So how's that going to work?
What's the point of going to a football match if there's only 1,000 of you there anyway?
I know.
It's ridiculous. We've got to get out of all this. This is crazy. This condition, this COVID-19 coronavirus, Kung Flu, as Donald Trump likes to call it, does not warrant all of this. It does not warrant what they're doing to this country. The economic catastrophe hurtling down the track is going to be like nothing we've ever experienced before. Mm. Rishi Sunak, people keep going, oh, he's great, he's great. You wait. In about six months...
he's great as long as he's got our money to give
away. You wait. In about 6 months, he's already starting to indicate that we're going to have to start paying for this no public sector pay rises and all sorts of other...
Well, mind you, I agree with that. There should be no public...
Well, no, but this all has to be paid for. Rishi Sunak is going to go from hero to zero pretty damn fast.
Mm, he really is. I think we're out of time because we've got lots to do. A lot of you saying that we should do more of these. We will be trying to do more of them. But at the moment, it's just one a week, I'm afraid. And we'll see you next week with the Thought Police. It's like people that I meet, and you've played a bit of golf in your time, people who cheat at golf.
Yes.
You kind of go, you're not really cheating me, you're now cheating yourself.
What is the point?
You know, if you're going to finish, I mean, when I used to play, I've told this story before, I used to play in this European Press Golf Association with my dad when I was a bit younger. And there was this old German guy whose name was something like Ralph, somebody or other. And you'd literally not see him from the tee to the green.
And
he'd go, "Fumph." Everything was fumph. He became known as Ralph Fumph because everything was fine. He almost, whenever he putted in, and you'd be seeing him hacking away in the woods, you know, he's taken at least 10 shots to get out of the fucking woods, and he's got five.
Yeah, the golfers are more footballers than golfers. They kick the ball
around. And to be
fair,
that's what they say about Trump, isn't it?
Trump's the kicker of the ball.
Kicks the ball over.
You listen to the polls a lot. You keep putting lots and lots of people want stricter restrictions. They want stricter measures.
Yeah.
I don't believe that.
No.
And I do not believe people support any more lockdowns.
I mean, I do see occasional kind of, you know, musings on social media by people who have those views. And there are people who are genuinely worried about their elderly relatives and all of that. But that's fine. They don't have to do anything. It's not like we're saying to them, right, well, now you have to invite me and Kevin O'Sullivan into your house so we can drink the place dry, cough all over you, and then leave. That's not what's happening.
Sir Desmond Swain, that redoubtable backbench Tory, good guy, was on my show.
I heard him last night. Yeah.
On my show. Well, did you hear what he said? He said, look, I've got a very elderly mother.
Mm.
I want her to come. I'm going to invite her to my house for Christmas. But she's obviously very vulnerable. It is her decision whether or not she wants to come to my house.
Mm.
It's not mine. It's not the government.
No.
By the way, I've been thinking, how am I going to spend that 10 quid that Mike Graham owes me? That bit.
Well, as I said to you, until the actual fat lady sings, you will not be getting any of my money.